I guess while we're waiting, I would like to announce what you sort of see on in front of you, the flyer, which is a worldview apologetics class being taught by good old Jeremy. Most of you, I think, have met him. And Jeremy is offering this class at the usual times, starting late August. And it'll be covering worldviews in a different sense. So I think I remember one of our first classes together, I mentioned there's really two ways you can think of worldviews, and that is in terms of what we've been doing, which is worldviews as the Christian worldview, and the main themes in the Christian worldview being creation, fall, redemption, and today, vocation or calling, right? So creation, fall, redemption. But there's a second way to think about worldviews, which is sort of like world religions. And this is where Jeremy's heading with that theme. And so it's kind of a nice kind of segue into, well, here's what the Christian worldview is. Okay, so let's see how it lines up against other worldviews, as it were. So that's the two senses of worldviews. And so it's a really nice segue, actually, over to his class starting in late August. Well, like I said, I'm sure there's a few others maybe trickling in owing to traffic. So why don't we go ahead and make a start and start in a word of prayer. Would anyone like to pray for us as we get started? I often say to my students, any Christians in the room? I'm just kidding. But sometimes not, right? So, okay. Yeah, thanks, Chris. Amen. Thanks. All right. Well, as you know, Chris was praying. You know, there are a couple things that we want to look at tonight that actually, yeah, as we sort of struggle with ourselves as well as the culture, hopefully these things will help us navigate, you know, through our lives and through society as we see it. And here's the broad general outline of tonight. We're going to be talking about calling, vocation, profession, three terms, two of which are pretty much synonymous, and then the second one being slightly different. And then we're going to talk about secondary calling. Okay, let me back up, actually. If you look at calling, vocation, and profession, and you had to guess that two of those are actually synonyms and the third one isn't, which would you, any of you know which ones are synonymous?
Calling and vocation.
Calling and vocation. Very good. How do you know that?
Because I read the...
Oh, wow, wonderful. Okay, so you can't be wrong. Now, how do you know it, you know, etymologically, or how do you know it just from your own context? Any other thoughts? Or from the notes.
calling is what you do, and vocation is what you do, but profession is who you are.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I actually might say, we probably mean the same thing, but I might say it's just slightly the other way. So calling and vocation have a lot to do with who we are, identity, right? Trying to think through all the areas of our life and bring those together. And then profession is sort of, hey, I'm a mechanical engineer, right? Or I'm a, you know, that's kind of what you do in a sense. But maybe you mean it in a larger sense, what you do with your whole life. Because if that's what you mean, then maybe, yeah, vocation and calling would be a better term.
Well, I always used to tell my kids that your profession is what you want to do with your life. Your vocation is what you want to do while you're waiting for your profession. And which vocation should you get?
Okay. You know, and here's the thing, right? It could well be that perhaps in terms of, because words, right? Words actually don't mean anything except the meaning we give it. Now, that sounds very like, very postmodern or whatever, right? But it's actually not. If, for example, I mean, it sounds crazy, but if, for example, You know, we all, starting today, 2015, decided to call this thing ketchup. And we just did for the rest of the generations. And, you know, 5,000 years later, people will say, oh, can you hand me a bottle of ketchup? I need to clean the whiteboard, right? People wouldn't blink at it because we pour the meaning into it and it carries on, right? Now, so it's interesting, Roddy, because maybe over time, in terms of the decades here in America, perhaps things have become, you know, quite a reverse of what we understand them originally to be. But in terms of the root, right, vocare, as we talked about there in Latin, is literally a call, right, to call. And so calling and vocation are synonymous in that way. And profession is literally the thing that you go about doing at your job. But you're right, it's hard to clean it up that neatly, because what is it that we're professing, right? So they actually perhaps historically share a similar context. But from what I gather in our context today, and if you look at the Latin, vocare and calling, they're really quite synonymous. Whereas profession, people will say, hey, what's your profession? You know, I'm an engineer, or I'm a teacher, or, you know, I'm a nurse, and what have you, right? But again, we don't put too much stock in the terms. But just so we're on the same page for now, let's consider calling to be the more fundamental thing, of which profession is a part, right? Our 9-to-5 job is a part of our larger calling, but calling is larger, okay? So let's think of it that way, right? One thing that I took from Oz's book, The Call, is he talks about primary calling and secondary calling, okay? Primary calling is something we're not actually going to talk a whole lot about tonight. It's something that that can be defined simply as our discipleship, right? Our response to the one who calls us. So that's always primary, right? I think I say in my notes something like primary calling is to the Lord who calls us, and secondary calling is all the things that follow from our devotion to the Lord, right? So secondary calling includes profession, right? Now, when it comes to secondary calling, so here we have on your PowerPoint, your notes and whatnot. When it comes to secondary calling, I want us to think about those in terms of how strategic they are or can be, and secondly, as how sacred they are or can be. Right? Like I said, we're not going to focus too heavily on primary calling. We are going to think a little bit more in terms of secondary calling. A lot of us, just looking around the room, probably have moved quite close to what our secondary calling is in our lives. Some of us, perhaps those of us who are younger, will say, well, I kind of have an idea, but I'm still kind of moving and trying to get central to my calling. In fact, I'll share with you, you know, quite candidly, this is something that I am struggling with, even having just kind of turned that big corner that they call age 40 earlier this year. And I'm just kind of thinking about, oh, what does it mean to be central to my calling? And a lot of you, like me, live in Southern California and recognize that what we're passionate about doesn't pay very well, right? Like this Thursday night, if all of us got paid to think and read and write about apologetics and worldviews, that would be a pretty sweet deal. But not, as far as I've seen, not too many, you know, jobs wanted ads or whatever, you know, people wanted ads out there, right, for that kind of a calling. So there's a passion element, but there's more than just a passion element. And so we want to think about secondary calling as strategic and sacred. We'll talk about that. And then the second big topic I want to talk about tonight is what I call the GPS of our in the kingdom, finding our GPS. Obviously, that refers to a navigation system, but it's a little acronym that I hope will be helpful in thinking about, well, what is it that we ought to be, what part should we play in the kingdom, right? So that's kind of how I like to talk about it, as GPS. And this just stands for gifts, passions, and serving God's purposes, our GPS. Fun little acronym. I'm still toying with this, and maybe Brenda or others can help me with this. Fides, as well. So about, you know, In one place in my notes, I think I refer to it as GPS, and then the other place in my notes, I refer to it as gaps in the kingdom, because what I'm trying to suggest is there are actually gaps in God's kingdom that He calls us to fill, right? But I don't know if that's more useful than using like GPS, which is helpful in terms of navigating our life and that sort of thing. So I'm kind of open to that. I'm trying to finish writing a book on this that'll probably end in 20 years from now. But I am working on it, and so I'm trying to figure out what might work there. 20 years from now, we might not have GPS anymore, so that's the worry. And then finally, kind of we'll end with a time of encouragement, hopefully, from the Word. And so that'll be our third and last kind of piece for tonight. Okay, so homing in on the first piece, calling, vocation, and profession, as we just discussed, and with Roddy's help, I think we can all see that calling and vocation are quite similar. And calling I define very simply as that arena of life. Okay, it sounds kind of funny to put it this way. But remember back to our earlier lectures where I said, when you have a term that's really familiar, like the word red or chair or friend, for some reason it's actually very hard to define. And it's probably because it is so familiar that it's hard to define. Like if I ask you, go ahead and define the word red or apple. Define it. You guys are like, oh, that's easy. Delicious fruit. Does that work for pear? Oh, okay, hold on. Delicious fruit that's either green or red, right? So it's not easy to define familiar terms. And the same with calling. You have to get really technical to define very familiar terms. It's a weird phenomenon of life. But if I ask you to define chair, you say, oh, the thing that you sit on so that you can rest. Tree stump, does that work, right? You see how it already is very difficult? It's the same thing with calling. We have to use these weird definitions because the word is too familiar. And so we actually have to kind of distance her. So here's my attempt to do that. Calling is that arena of analysis, activity, and asking. And by that, of course, I just mean prayer. Okay, it's that arena of our life of analysis, activity, and asking for which, okay, the arena for which one is uniquely gifted and unquestionably passionate. Okay? So it's that space, maybe, or time, or that arena in our life where analysis happens, we think a lot about it. Activity happens, we do a lot with it. And asking happens, we want to pray that God blesses us in this endeavor. And it's something that we ought to be quite uniquely gifted in and unquestionably passionate about. That's my best attempt at trying to define something like secondary calling. Okay, this will flesh this out a bit more. But again, just really quickly, just to make sure we're on the same page, let's distinguish very quickly between primary and secondary calling. Again, I'm taking this pretty wholesale from a lot of Oz's work in his book called The Call. But the primary calling would be to the one who calls us to deny ourselves, take up the cross, and follow Him. It's discipleship. It's devotion. It's our identity in Christ, right? Our primary calling always goes first. The indicative, as we said last week, comes before the imperative. The indication of who we are comes before what we do, as Roddy put it, right? The what we do comes after the who we are, okay? So the secondary comes after the primary, obviously enough. Okay, so again, we're going to focus on secondary as we go ahead here. All right, now, why do I think of secondary calling as strategic? Now, it's funny. I actually, years ago, actually had a chance to sit with Oz, you know, who wrote this book, right, The Call. And I told you guys about this in my notes, but I actually had lunch with him with a few others, and I said to Oz, don't you think that one of the most strategic ways, if Christians are all about changing the world, changing culture, right, don't you think one of the most strategic ways would be to break into Hollywood, write those songs, write those films that everyone else, is reading, watching and so forth, or video games or all the rest, right? Create the new, like, Instagram or whatever, right, app. Or go into politics, right? Like, John Calvin thought that was the most strategic calling, right? Right. Okay, so that was my question to Oz. Don't you think that would be very strategic if there was a Christian chairman CEO of that new Apple Watch or something, and then he can put like an interesting subliminal Christian message. No, it's okay. Every time you look at it, you want to become Christian or something. No, but isn't there a strategic way of and so his response to me, quite to my surprise, was no. He said, He said, no, it's calling is everyone, everywhere, doing everything, right? And I was like, but Oz, I mean, don't you think that if there were like more Ralph Winters who created the X-Men series, right, and Crouching Tiger and all that, right? Or if there were more like Lecrae or like Switchman and all the rest, right? If there were more of that, don't you think we would be more effective in changing culture and changing the world? He says, no. Calling is everyone, everywhere, doing everything. I was like, stop saying that. It was that kind of a lunch, right? But after, you know, sort of years of kind of thinking through this, and sure enough, the disciple is humbled by the master, because I think Oz is completely right about that. I think it's everyone, everywhere, doing everything, and everyone's profession is just as sacred as the next person. Now, that said, we have to be careful, right? Because the word sacred is a very difficult term, too, again. Here's why I think there's two exceptions to what Oz is saying. I'm sure he would agree. But let me just give you some absurd examples of why I think strategy does matter, and strategy doesn't quench the Spirit, so to speak. It doesn't. I think strategy and relying on the Holy Spirit can go together, okay? Here's why. Let's just say the whole Christian church, the invisible church, right, as Augustine would say, or the whole church worldwide, all Christians everywhere, suddenly just felt this deep calling on their life to be professional basket weavers, right? And I say in my notes, as beautiful as some of these baskets may be, because indeed, that is a profession that is sacred in itself. But if literally the whole world over, who are Christian, said, oh, you know, I just got this weird sense, but I got this calling to basket weave, and underwater basket weaving more specifically, or whatever, right? You draw out the absurdity of the example. We can see that, wait a second, that may not be very strategic for us as Christians to do that, right? Let's actually be wise, right, about what we're talking about. So I think, again, that's just an absurd example, but that is a helpful example, because when we get to the end of our definition of calling, at the end of the day, what we're doing is with our gifts and with our passion, that's the G and the P, the S is we're serving God's purposes in this generation. What purpose of God would underwater basket weaving serve? I'm sorry to say, but we need to be a little bit more strategic than that. You see the absurd point that I'm trying to make? Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very good. Yeah, yeah. And you, yeah, that's right. Yes. Oh, okay, so there's always that, right? Moses not being gifted. Now, does anyone know the response to that? Like sometimes, intellectually, what was really going on there with Moses? Anyone know about whether that was a genuine objection that he had with God? So,
his expression is,
he's gifted.
He's quite gifted. In the Pharaoh's palaces, right? So he actually, that would have much, you know, so a lot of scholars, commentators would agree that that very much was more of an excuse. Whereas if you just look at his training, like Paul was very much gifted, right? So he was much like Paul in that way. So yeah, looking at his background is probably more of an excuse. But you're right, there are exceptions, right, to the gifts and the passions, which we'll talk about, but you're getting ahead of me. but no, that's good. Yes. Sure. That's right. Yeah, there's a way to over-strategize everything that we do quench the Spirit, right? And we don't rely on, we don't do the asking, the third of the A's. You're right. We need to keep that in mind. Wayne. Yeah. Right.
And I take the third step and he shows me the fourth step.
That's right, yeah.
But I don't know what the 25th step is until I take the step.
Most of us don't. That's right.
You know, so is it my strategy or is it God's strategy?
That's right, yeah. So the Ethiopian eunuch, we're told to go, and then you see what happens when you get there. But it, you know, 1 through 10 isn't laid out. Right, exactly.
Now, if you get back to Moses, actually, he was in Pharaoh's court. That's true. As a matter of fact, he was Pharaoh's favorite. However, let's remember that he killed an Egyptian. And because he killed an Egyptian, he ran.
Yes.
And he was gone for a long, long time. And not only that, when God asked him to speak to Pharaoh, he had been in the desert 40 years then. So maybe he felt like he was beat down and not really the hierarchy of being the second in command of the Egyptian army at that time.
Now, this is true.
Remember that the basic rule is that God qualifies the called, he doesn't call the qualified.
Nice. Yeah. That's right. He calls first and then he'll take care of the sanctification and the equipping. That's right. So I think that's right. So there will be exceptions, right? You may be called to something that you're not terribly gifted at. You may be called to things that you're not terribly passionate about. So this is definitely true. I want to make sure that we agree there will be these exceptions. But I think they are exceptions, right? I think generally speaking, those who have the mind of an engineer end up as good engineers. And that is a good part of their calling, right? And so forth, right? So there will definitely be exceptions, and I will point to Mother Teresa, I think I mentioned in my notes, right? As even, I think when she was being interviewed on for a number of different biographies, she admitted quite candidly that she wasn't very interested, I mean, that's not the exact way we should put it, but sometimes, a lot of times for her, it was just a dutiful thing to get up in the mornings and serve the poorest of the poor. It wasn't this driving, overwhelming passion and joy that she woke up with. No, it was just hard work. So there will be exceptions. And you're not going to always be passionate about what you do, but yet you ought to still do it, right? So thanks for clearing that up. But as I sort of look out into our world, I mean, we've talked about this earlier, but Oz's Three Global Menaces, and if I can't recommend that book enough, but that book, Renaissance, 140 pages, but excellent, excellent book. He talks about the three global tasks ahead of us, right? And I think we summarize them as Islamism, didn't we? Islamism. And then something like ideological, I mean, these are terms I kind of came up with to make it easy to remember. Consumerism. Not just consuming, that's okay. So, you know, we can buy laptops and watches and whatnot. But if it's a consumerism that consumes us, right? And we do it to the detriment of, say, the global south or what have you and so forth. And then the third thing is liberalism. Right, so he said these are some, and in that's terrible, and also illiteracy and ineligibility. Okay, I'm sorry, illiberal. Let's try that again. Liberalism. Okay, and in there, right, would be everything from religious freedom issues in Vanderbilt, where they had said you better allow an atheist to be the president of your Christian club, which is kind of crazy. Or human rights issues, same-sex marriage, those are all kind of would fall under here. Here it would be all sorts of issues of poverty and, you know, capitalism gone wrong and so forth. And then, of course, Islamism being a very, you know, violent form of Islam. So Oz looks out in the world and says, as far as I can see, and he says I could be completely wrong, but as far as he's studied and watched and prayed and seen, in this world, these are the three global tasks ahead of us, right? He refers to these as the three global condition. No, that's not true either. Menaces. Three global menaces. And then he refers to the three global tasks, the three tasks over here. I'm just going to say them, so for sake of time, plus you can't read my writing anyway, but the first one is prepare the global south, remember that? Help them to do better than the west has done, so prepare the global south for the coming modernity. Then secondly it was win back the west, and thirdly was contribute to the human future, right? So he says these are three tasks that are facing the church. These are three menaces that are facing the world. So what he does is he looks out into the world and says, well, you know, all that I've prayed and observed, this is what's going on. And so, in his words, perhaps these are some of the purposes of God in our generation. Perhaps we should be looking at some of these things. Sorry, I'll go ahead and write it. I know. So prepare the Global South, GS, okay, Global South. Win back the West, right? Because we don't just focus on one area of the world. The West needs us too. And so I do believe in missions to, say, England, where have you, where the church going rate is less than 5%, right? You know, where it was once the birthplace of Anglican Reformation and all the rest. And then thirdly, contribute to, the human future. So my point is this. Oz may be right, he may be wrong. He is the first to admit that in the book. But he's at least trying to give a picture of what God may be doing in the world. And the things that God's kingdom may need some help in, right? So as we consider what's going on, and as we talk to our children, or as we're thinking through college life and grad school and all the rest, perhaps it would be good for us to think about what are God's purposes in this generation. So again, to give the absurd example, and I'm going to get this later on, but to give the absurd example, again, let's suppose someone says, oh man, I feel so called. Okay, leave aside basket weaving, but I feel so called. I want to do this thing where, like, you could bind pages together, type some stuff, words out on a page, and then bind them and then, like, sell them so that people can read. And then someone's like, you mean the printing press? Because that was discovered about 450 years ago. It was invented about 450 years ago, right? No matter how cold that person might feel to it, you might want to just say, look, I don't know if that's God's purposes in this generation, because that did happen about 17 generations ago, right? It's an absurd example, but when we get closer to the edges, it's not so absurd. So, you know, if someone says, look, I think I want to... I don't know, maybe you guys can help me with some examples here. But if someone says to you, look, this is what I want to pursue, right? Let's say a dying industry, right? Then you say to, hey, look, I know you're passionate about that, but I know you're also gifted in this. Why don't you consider this? Because this is an area that the church needs, the world needs. It's a growing industry, right? So if, you know, I don't know, if someone wanted to come up with, like, you know, floppy disks or something, right? That's a dying industry. Smaller things can hold a lot more memory. Are you guys with me on that? Are you guys following me? So the point is, let's be wise, and there's nothing wrong with using strategy and wisdom as we think about our calling and using these kinds of helpful kind of grids. Okay.
When you say strategy, is vision.
Yes. Yeah. Right, exactly, yeah. So just using wisdom, something that will have an impact, potentially, right? Now, again, the worry is that we get overly strategic and we just worry about impact and numbers and all the rest. There's a danger there, too. But let's not get so afraid of strategy or wisdom or even impact or numbers, because, oh, well, it's more holy not to think about the outcomes. Well, and sometimes we do have to think about outcomes, right? We can't control the outcomes. God ultimately does. But, yes, let's be wise about what industries and what areas of calling that we're entering into. Yeah. So, for example, I just want to give us a heads up. This is a thought that I kind of came to me, and this is actually even before I was just sharing with Chris, but before my wife had actually considered this. But this is actually, I was thinking about this years ago. But as you know, as you well know, the mental health industry, especially, I mean, it's kind of funny to call it an industry, but the mental health world, just in our nation alone, as some of you well know, it's literally in the trillions of dollars. Now, that's not my invitation to you and say, oh, let's go capitalize in that industry somehow and, you know, charge people more. I mean, obviously, that's not at all what I'm saying. What I am saying is there is a world that needs people in this field. And for Christians to be in this field would be a very important work to do. I mean, this is more some ethnic cultures than others, but for some people, talking about mental health is still very taboo. Maybe for the Christian culture more generally, talking about rock and roll was very taboo, right, a generation or two ago. But we thank God for some people who've done really well in that world, so to speak, right? So in the same sense, as we're entering into this era, people are really feeling like they need some help in this area. So my wife she happens to be going to this area, and she's just going to school this fall. But this is a very important area, I think, that Christians can make a huge contribution to. It's like $2.8 trillion, whatever it was a couple of years ago, which is just staggering. You know, and it's strange. I mean, I can share this because some of us have friends, or maybe some of us are actually even from here. But we had a friend over in grad school here in the States, who noticed that we had a lot of counseling services and this sort of thing. And so this guy says to a couple of friends of mine and I, you know, I noticed you guys have, and this is, we're all Christians, right, in this group. And he was like, I noticed you guys, even as Christians, you have a lot of counseling centers. And I, yeah, that's probably important, but it's just strange to me, right? And so this chap actually happened to be from Africa. And so we said, well, what do you do? Why is that so strange? And he says, well, in Africa, we don't go to counseling services. We have friends, you know. And that was like a big sting to kind of where we are in that sense. Yes, there's some truth to that. But given where we have come, I think there still is a rightful place for Christians to enter into that world. And you know, maybe it's an industry that we hope one day doesn't exist anymore. But that's still a worthwhile industry to go into, right? I actually even know seminary professors. I won't name the place and I won't name the person, but he was very well respected and huge name in that seminary. But he actually said, my colleagues and I, and this is when I was in grad school, taking a couple, hearing about a couple classes, but anyways, he said, my colleagues and I have this secret wish to work ourselves out of a job, right? And so that's kind of a strange thing, but if you think about it, back in the day, a few hundred years ago, there were no such thing as seminary. Education either happened like this, at a church literally, right, where the pastor was the scholar, but also, your Harvards and all the rest, those started as your Biola, right? Even if you go to UCLA, which is not a very Christian school or have a Christian foundations even, but outside their halls, they have these Bible verses. If you go to Harvard, you'll see truth and for Christ and his kingdom. And, you know, Christ is the cornerstone of this university and all kinds of stuff. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, even if we're trying to work ourselves out of a job, those institutions and those industries are legitimate places that currently God is using to do good, and so we ought to freely engage those places. Yeah.
See, I think exactly what you're saying is important, but I think that African man is making a valid point. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
I think it would almost eliminate it.
Yes.
Because Jesus is my friend. Mm-hmm. And if I realize that and I understand that, that's going to alleviate a lot of problems.
It will. And yet we're embodied creatures, and so we're called to be in community. But you're right. Having true community would make a huge impact.
Real community.
Yes.
Because sometimes what do we do in this kind of society today? We're isolated.
Right. Yeah.
We don't have friends.
Yeah. So here's the thing, right? So this is the point that we're making is, you're right, let's enter into those so that maybe they will one day no longer exist. But take, for example, in Oxford, where our typical teaching style was one tutor, one or two students, right? They've been doing that for about 800 years. They're still doing that. I actually got a chance to do some tutoring when I was there. And it was one student and me, and that was it. In America, I teach at Biola. What's the ratio of one of my classes I teach? It's 100 to 1. It's one of me and 100 students, right? So I tell them consistently, your best education at Biola is not going to be in this lecture hall. They're like, oh, wow, that's encouraging. I said, look, the very best education you can get, some of it's going to happen in dorm rooms, some of it's going to happen in the cafe, but a really good place to get your education is at office hours or in my 5 a.m. morning jogs. But because you can't come jog with me in Irvine, you ought to come to my office hours. Because that is, like, when Jesus, and I saw all the times I walk with him too, but when Jesus taught his disciples, it was a very life-on-life discipleship. I think Socrates was a great teacher. I think a lot of these, you know, context is much more suited to teaching than 100 to 1. But that said, and here's the point that Wayne's bringing out, here I am in the middle of a 100-student lecture hall teaching them that education happens better in smaller circles. So one day, maybe, we'll get to the place financially where American can sustain a better educational model where it's much closer to the older school of 1-on-2, 1-on-12 maybe, right? But I have to use the American educational lecture hall to get that message out. So it's kind of a funny thing, right? So my hope is, like, my point is to them is, like, one day you'll get me out of a job. And, you know, and if you do start another university, hire me. That's my point. But the point is well taken. It's a social reality we live in. That's why sociology is so important. But we have a theological ideal that we want to aim toward. And we always have to keep that kind of our true north, as it were. Yeah. So very good. Okay. So... So speaking of strategic, oh gosh, we're doing well in keeping our discussion lively, but we need to also press on. So let me go a bit more quickly if I can. I have a good friend named Sean. I don't know. Some of you guys may actually know him, but that's actually his real name. And here's a good looking picture of him. Well, maybe not so good looking, but that's a picture of him. No, I'm just kidding, Sean. If you're watching this, okay. But Sean is a really good friend of mine. One of his biggest goals in life, and I don't know if this is too public a place, he's fine with me saying this in my lectures at Biola, but one of his real big goals in life is just actually make a lot of money so that he can fund Christian scholars and give them scholarships to go on for PhDs. Like, that's a really cool, strategic, very strategic calling that he feels that he has, right? I think, and I was just sharing with Chris earlier today, but I actually happen to work for a group called the Templeton Foundation. Big part of my job is literally going to different places in the world to essentially give away hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Every year, the foundation gives out $175 million a year. I was just in Hong Kong and the Philippines to meet with various people whose project we can fund. The Fulbright Foundation, right? Exactly. These are foundations that have been set up by visionaries who are very strategic about placing people, right, in various places of scholarship. So exactly. Yes. Scholarship. Yeah. So that's beautiful, right? I think we have to recapture the fact that, look, strategy doesn't quench the spirit. I think we oftentimes think it's either going to be Holy Spirit-led or strategy-led. Why does it have to be one or the other, right? We can still be shrewd as serpents, but innocent as doves. And I think this is a little bit what Christ was talking about as he was sending out his disciples, right? And so, yes, let's be strategic. At the same time, there will be things that God does that's just completely unbeknownst to us, right? It's just completely out of left field, but it was exactly the thing that needed to happen. So, for example, Paul, strategy, right? He's heading to Rome. That's where he wants to go, because if you can get to Rome, then you can get to the Roman Empire, right? So Paul used strategy, and that was blessed. At the same time, sometimes he would head in the wrong direction, heading over to Asia, was redirected by the Spirit. So it's ultimately Spirit-led, right? So that we have to remember it is both, but we're never called to just, you know, just relinquish all, you know, thought to the wind, as it were, right? Kick all thoughts to the wind and just go, oh, well, I'm going to be led by the Holy Spirit. We need to be strategic. But as I just say here, don't over-strategize either. We'll skip the illustrations for now, for time's sake. All right. Now, secondary calling should also be sacred. It should be strategic, and it should also be sacred. What someone can point out and say to me, huh, wait a second, Park, didn't you say everything in life is sacred? All of life is worship? Yes, I did say that. Now, what might be helpful here is actually if we distinguish between two different distinctions, okay? One of them would be, what's the usual pairing that comes with sacred? It's blank versus sacred.
Secular.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. Yeah. Secular versus sacred. That's usually a distinction that comes up, right? Secular versus sacred. However, we learn that this word secular isn't exactly the opposite of sacred, right? We know what sacred means, right? Sanctified, it's holy unto God. But secular, remember we discussed this? It's not exactly the opposite, not unholy. Secular, we said, was what? Do you guys remember the Augustinian definition of secular? Seculum versus eschaton? Is it? I think I heard it. That's right, plural. Good. Okay. So, is that what you said? Oh, okay. Well, it is now. Okay, no, okay. I said it's plural, right? Or pluralistic. Seculum just means this earth, right? As opposed to eschaton, which is, you know, end times, eschatology, right? And Augustine says, look, we live in a secular existence. What did he mean? He just means we live in a plural, this worldly, many different kinds of people. That's all he meant, right? So secular, the true meaning of it, it just means plural, pluralistic. And that's why we can say all of life is sacred. So there isn't this hard divide between, oh, that's secular work. Oh, this is sacred work. Oh, you're an engineer. Oh, I'm a pastor. No, no, there is none of that. All of life is sacred, right? Now, that said, I think we do need to make a different distinction, which I like to use a different word altogether usually, but here I just use sacred because, to be honest, it's just because it's an alliteration with strategic and sacred, that's the only reason. But a more helpful term would be to think of the distinction between profane and holy. But again, this we could use sacred, but it gets confusing because we want to make sure that we don't believe that secular is the opposite. But profane and holy, that actually is, I think, a meaningful distinction. Why? Because the job of a social worker, whether that social worker is a Christian or not, I think is a holy, sacred work. The job of a pornographer, we can't say that's holy or sacred. That's certainly profane. You see why I'm trying to reintroduce this distinction, but not using those terms, because we want to remember all of life is sacred. There's every area of life is an area that God could be worshipped in, right? From the toy tot to the top of a skyscraper, all of these things are arenas of life of worship. So in that sense, it's all sacred, okay? There's no hierarchy, pastor versus plumber. No, there's no hierarchy. That said, you could be engaged in a secondary calling that's very much not at all holy or sacred, but very much profane. So, that's why I think it's very important for us to remember that. Because some people say, oh, but, you know, look, all of life is sacred. Can't I just, like, own a liquor store? That's tough, right? You guys see why it's tough, right? Because you're... Liquor in itself is not wrong, right? Unless you're a teetotaler, which, okay, we can agree to disagree. But hold on a second. You're kind of contributing to the possibility of them getting hooked on alcohol. Or you're selling magazines in a place that typically a liquor store would sell. You guys get the picture.
Or you work in a secret factory.
Yeah, like what? Oh, like a sweatshop, do you mean?
Oh,
a cigarette factory. Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? And so, but it's tough, right? So you have no other job, and now you're just working because you're just an accountant at the cigarette factory. You see where there are degrees in a sense, right? There's a spectrum of holy and profane. But there are some obvious profane ones that we can all point to, right? Sex trafficking, pornography, right? Those who deliberately contribute to the economic oppression of the poor and so forth. And then there are jobs that are a little bit more in the middle. So this is a lot of discerning has to go on there. But I just want to point out that let's not give people a freebie and say, oh, look, all of life is sacred. I'm going to go own a casino. Yes, you can own a casino and you may not lose your salvation, but it's going to be kind of hard to explain that one, as it were, right? That's some explaining to do. right? Okay. All right. So just some, again, obvious examples. All of life is sacred, therefore I can shout at my spouse. That's, no, hold on a second. That is not sacred, right? Okay. I know I'm being quite extreme, but sometimes that helps us to get closer to thinking through the more in-the-middle stuff. Because in-the-middle stuff, that's really hard. Again, casino owner, well, I'm tithing $1 million a week, okay? Does God want that? Right? So, again, that's the hard stuff. Okay, so we've covered that. Secondary callings being both strategic and sacred, and those two being important ways to think about calling. And then secondly, we want to talk about GPS or gaps. Again, like I said, I kind of go back and forth between these terms, but gifts, passions, and serving God's purposes. Okay, so what is our GPS and how can we fill the gaps, as it were, of God's kingdom? Well, here's how I want us to think about it. And maybe for some of you, this is old hat. You can probably put it much more eloquently than I have. Some of you, this is very helpful. And I don't necessarily divide it up into generations, right? I'm so glad I'm 40, because then I can kind of speak to the young people like I'm one of you, and then speak to the older people like I'm one of you, and I can always play the good card, right? Like, oh no, I'm totally with you. And every time, like, yeah, I know, they're kind of weird, aren't they? You know, that kind of thing. Always get away with it. But... exactly. What do you think? I'll just agree with you. Okay. But gifts, right? Okay. Here's my attempt at defining gifts. Okay. Again, I apologize for the weird definition, but like I tell you, the more familiar the term, the harder the thing is to define. I'm telling you, it's hard to define a chair. Try it. It's not easy. Okay. So that's why gift, oh, that's an easy word, so familiar, but that's why it's so hard. Here's my best shot. It's those capacities to engender, bring about goodness, truth, and beauty. Okay, I think that's what gifts are. It's those capacities that we possess to bring about goodness, truth, and beauty. The transcendentals that we talked about, remember 2 weeks ago or a couple weeks ago? To create. Goodness, truth, and beauty. That's what gifts are for. And if you think about it, like, oh yeah, I'm gifted at singing the song or making the song, right? That's bringing about beauty, right? That's just as Fides is saying. Now, it's those capacities to engender goodness, truth, and beauty, the exercise of which comes pretty naturally to us. Would you agree that kind of is a pretty important part of a definition of gifts, right? Because if it didn't come very naturally to us, I don't know if we'd call it a gift. We might call it a skill that you worked at for many years, but we wouldn't call it a gift, right? So it comes pretty naturally to us. And then here's the other component. And in exercising a gift, we actually feel most like ourselves, right? And you guys have all been there. You guys have been in those moments in your lives where like, man, this is what I think I was created for, right? You've been in those places. I actually remember a time very vividly when I had this experience. It was all the way out in the Philippines, in Los Baños, in the south of the zone. And I just had given a talk, much like this, to a group of pastors and grad students. And it was on apologetics, and we had a Q&A, and it went on and on and on, as you know, as much as we do here. And I came back to my room, and I emailed my mentor, Dave Horner, and I said, Dave, that's all I wrote. I said, Dave, I think I know what I was created for, right? And then he just happened to be on email, to give, despite the time zones, but he wrote back pretty much right away, and he said, Rich, he phrased it in an interesting way. I'm still trying to figure out the whole of what he means here. But he said, listen to your body. He said, listen to your body, because this doesn't happen much for many people in their life. Right? And I'm still trying to get the whole... We talked about embodied Christianity last week. I'm still trying to get the whole of what he meant by that. But there was something... I think there's something very rich there. And that is the kind of thing that I think has a lot to do with our gifting, hopefully. You guys are like, no, Rich, actually, that's not... No, sorry. But that's my hope and prayer that it is. Now, hopefully this is helpful. The second thing is, let's distinguish it between a skill. Because a skill and a gift are slightly different. A skill is something that you can work at over time and get there, right? Whereas a gift, again, it's somewhat innate, not 100% innate. Okay, you have to work at it too. But it's a little bit more innate than a skill is, right? Here's what I mean. Like picking apples. That's a skill that some people get right away. Other people take a little bit of time. But we can all get there. We can all pick ripe apples, right? If we're told what to look for, you know, the watermelon thing, right? How do you hit it and all that, right? You can develop that skill. But then to start up an international apple trading company that's global, like that's it's a bit more of a gifting. It takes a special kind of person to have the vision and all the rest, right? Or even more so, the Apple phone, iPhone, okay? That's a gift that Steve Jobs had that, you know, you and I don't have. And the reason I know that is because you didn't give me $1 million yet. So skill and gift are quite different, aren't they? Now, the exercising of our gifts is something that others should enjoy. I'll come back to that in a minute. Passions. Passions, here's my best attempt to define it. Passions are those dispositions of the heart, and by that, again, Brenda helped us last week, but that's a broad term, heart. Not just your emotions, okay, but your thoughts and all of your affect. It's those dispositions of the heart in virtue of which we deeply desire to bring about that goodness. What does that mean? All that means is this. Go back to the song illustration. You bring about a song that's beautiful. You're bringing about goodness, truth, and beauty, the beauty. It's those those you're naturally disposed, you're inclined to bring those about. Right? You've got that desire.
Sorry. Maybe like zeal,
Yeah, you have a zeal that won't let go of you, right? I think someone, and this is kind of helpful, but somebody, I think, what's his name? Parker Palmer, I think is his name. So maybe you might know Brenda. Others you might. He defined calling as something you can't not do, right? So you have to do it, right? So for some of you, it's writing. You can't not write. You have to write. You blog every chance you get. You journal and you submit pieces and all, right. You can't not do it. It's something like that, right? It's those dispositions of the heart. You're kind of leaning. You're out of which, or in virtue of which, we deeply desire to write that song. Like, I just can't shake that deep desire. Right, okay. And it's that which we cannot not do. Right? Did I get that right? That which we cannot not do. Yeah, gotta do it. And in fact, if we go again to the Greek, the term for passion actually means to suffer. Right? That's why we call it Passion Week, when Christ suffered. And it's something that we're willing to suffer for. You think about it in those terms as well. I'm trying to put it in a number of different ways because actually it kind of helps us see, oh, okay, that resonates. Oh, I'm kind of getting what my passion is. And it's the expression of which our the expression of our passions make us feel most alive. So if gifts make us feel most like ourselves, oh, this is what I was created for, then passion is what makes us feel most alive. Like, I could do this 100 times and nobody pays me and I'm good, right? I like to put it this way to my students, and this is usually helpful. Passions are things that you like doing. Okay, very simple way of putting it. Gifts are things that others like you doing. Right? Because if you're passionate about something, but others don't like you doing it, it might not be your calling. You know what I'm saying? Like, I am not called to be a singer. No. Right? Like, I may be passionate about it. I do a lot in the shower. What I'm saying is, others don't enjoy it so much. And this is someone who actually was a praise leader in college. Okay. So maybe there's a lot of agony going on.
It's not for us, it's just for me.
That's right. It's just for me. This is my own gift to myself. Okay. But no, that's right. It's what you like, it's what you enjoy doing, and it's also what others enjoy you doing, right? That then you're kind of getting, your parents love you being a medical doctor, but you don't. Again, maybe that's not. Sometimes yes, but most times no. Wait, to have both, I think, is you're getting more central to your calling, right? Okay, so again, passions often, here's other ways to think about it. They often dominate our thought life, drive us to work, inspire us to dream, make us wish things were different. Keep us awake, they wake us up, make us wait. Or maybe I should probably better put it is help us to wait. Cause us to pray, get us talking, as well as draw us into silent pondering and stir our souls. This is what passions do. And if I can phrase it in enough different ways, hopefully this is helpful to get us to. And I'm saying this again, S40. I can say this, but I'm reevaluating some things in my own life, right? There's a number of things that I'm doing that I'm very passionate about. Hopefully I'm gifted in. And obviously some of those things to me include my teaching at Biola, my working for the John Templeton Foundation. I'm really passionate about these things. There are other things in my life that I do to help financially the livelihood of someone, you know, who may, you know, live in Southern California. How's that? Live in Orange County where it's not easy, right, to keep up with the livelihood. So there's other things that I do, but I'm reevaluating how central is that to my calling, right? How central is that to serving God's purposes in this generation? So they're just trying to word it in multiple different ways to help us kind of think through that. And for those of us who have, you know, lived a life of calling for 40, 30, 40 years, you have much to teach us. But even if we're into our 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s and feel like, wait a second, I'm pretty much done. Hold on a second. God might have yet an entire 30 more years to write with your life. In fact, I was actually with Oz this afternoon for lunch, and we were chatting, and he was telling me about someone that he met at Baylor University, who he met about 5 years ago, was 98 years old, but just as spry and spirited as ever. He sees him again just recently. He's 103. Looks like he hasn't aged a day, and he was the first one to raise his hand during Q&A, right? I mean, just come on, right? I mean, sometimes we're like, oh, well, I'm hitting the golden years, and soon it's sunset years, and wait a second, you don't know whether you have 1 year, one decade, or three, right? So this is something I want to just kind of help us to keep thinking about. Okay, another way, what inspires me to dream, what makes me, those are the same, aren't they? which values of the kingdom, goodness, truth, and beauty, do we want to see reflected, reinforced, and reified in the world? Okay, we're going to have to move on for time's sake. The other part, okay, I already said this part, that the and is important because it should be gifts and passion. Yes, there's exception, right? Sometimes we're not passionate about it, but we're called to it. But I think they are exceptions. And then finally, the S and the GPS is serving God's purposes, right? Serving God's purposes. As I say in your notes, and I again take this from Oz, but he writes about how King David, his life, and we've looked at this verse already two or three times in this class, so we don't have to turn there again, but you know that in Acts 13, there's this almost, not a throwaway, of course, but there's almost this summary of King David's life that's literally in half a sentence, which he basically says this: King David had served the purposes of God in his own generation, and then he fell asleep, which means he died, right? King David served the purposes of God in his generation, and fell asleep. That is a pretty darn cool thing to have on your tombstone, right, or as an epitaph or obituary, that you serve the purposes of God. And I think this is the third component, crucial component of calling. Yes, gifts, yes, passion. Now, what is the Lord doing? And the grids were up here earlier, but what is the Lord doing? And can I align myself with what He's doing? Because He's already gifted you and made you passionate about certain things that He's already doing in this world. So now we need to be prayerful as we observe what God is doing and fill in those gaps, as it were, with our gifts and our passions. Right? Right, yeah, in Acts 20:24. Oh, no, sorry, you're thinking of way right in Timothy. Yeah. Yeah, finished the race, I kept the good fight, I fought the good fight, right? And now I'm being poured out. Yeah, definitely, right? Because he uses a different analogy there, right? In terms of the race and the fight and so forth. But that's precisely what finding that purpose, not just the purpose of your life, but the purpose of God in this generation, right? That's an interesting distinction that you just brought up, you know, because, it just made me think there. Can we make a distinction between the purpose of life and the purposes of God in this generation? Or is it we hope that those two things come together? Something to think about. Rick Warren obviously talks a lot about the first. Yes, Yes. So long as you know we're prayerful, right? Yeah, I think that's right. Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, please. Yes. Yes. Right. So, again, maybe it's helpful to kind of, that's good, to take a step back and say, well, what do we mean by calling? Now, a lot of us, and I think, you know, a lot of us do this, we think of calling in terms of like, if I can just look carefully enough at the stars, as it were, quote unquote, right? Then maybe I can discern somewhere, some voice, some visible sign to the way that I'm supposed to spend Monday through Friday for the next 40 years. But I'm not so sure that calling works that way. Sometimes they do, right? Paul knocks off his horse and, you know, Christ calls him very clearly, very, you know, abruptly. Oz doesn't share this too much publicly, but he does occasionally. He actually felt that he actually had a very distinct call from England to the U.S. back in 84 when he first came. And sure enough, he did. And he came, and, you know, if there's anyone whose life we can look at and say, wow, he's made a contribution to American evangelicalism, it's Oz Guinness, right? And so it's hard to doubt. But I think way more often than not, it isn't any audible voice or visible sign. In fact, I agree with Oz again on this. He says it's usually a matter of trial and error. So he actually tried out the pastorate. He was preaching for a while and went to a church, and that failed miserably, and he realized he might be quite passionate, but wasn't gifted at all in that way, although we would all probably disagree, but, you know, that's what he noticed. And then he, you know, considered a few other things, and he was a reporter at the BBC for a while, and, you know, he pursued that a little bit. And so a lot of this trial and error, it's rarely a calling as in, like, well, if I can just match up to the thing that's already there. But I actually think that's why I want to look at it from a little more ground up, is if we can, okay, look at our gifts, look at our passions, then look out to the world, what is God doing? If we can align these three things, we might get close to our calling, right? These don't necessarily equal our calling because, again, trial and error. But if we can use these very just, maybe some pieces of wisdom as we think about this, and as we step into those, then we'll be affirmed, right, and confirmed, as it were, into what we're doing. So I guess my response is, let's be very on the ground, feet on the ground, and think just very, almost in a sense, commonsensically, gosh, I believe God has gifted me in this area. I certainly enjoy doing this sort of thing. And you bet, you know, there are hurting people that need counseling, right? I'm just giving an example. Gosh, maybe that's where the direction I should head in, right? Or, this is showing quite a bit of where I am, but, you know, I'm very passionate about teaching, and I love that space between the church and the academy, right? So my dad's a pastor. I've never really fully felt called to be a pastor in that sense, or felt, I don't know, again, using the term, but I just never saw myself fully being a senior pastor of a church, this kind of thing. I love the idea of teaching at a university, but will I want to do that only, full-time, exclusively, nothing else? It's hard because I have such a heart for ministry, right? And so I've always felt called to that space between the church and the academy. Who hires people like that? Nobody, right? And so that's why I strategically try to make my livelihood in teaching at Biola, and thank goodness, well, actually, literally, thank God for Templeton, okay, because they have a lot of money. Makes me able to live. But again, my point is, so my passion is about that. Like, I'm writing that piece on same-sex marriage because I'm really passionate about it. I want to write it well. Professors can talk about it, but do they really reach the wide audience? Pastors, unfortunately, some of them have rainbow profile pictures on Facebook. Do you see what I'm saying? So I don't know if it's the church's job only or if it's the academia that's going to do it. That missing middle, which is what Oz calls it, between the church and the academy, that's a space I really want to walk into and see. But gosh, my wife likes to eat, and so do I. And we need shelter. And so how do we make that happen? So that's why, because I'm so passionate about it, And I've been affirmed a bit. You know, it's a bit of a gifting for me. And it seems like it's serving God's purposes, at least in our generation. And so, gosh, then if that's true, and this is why I was saying it earlier a number of times, like I'm reevaluating things a little bit, maybe I need to kind of continue walking down that road a bit more. But it's just a step at a time, like Wayne was saying, right? It's one chapter at a time, and you put it out there, and you go, and maybe God affirms, and you go further, or it's really not happening. So, right, sorry, yeah. Long answer to your... Yeah. Yes. Yes. Thanks. Yeah, that's good. That's good to note. Yes. Yeah. So it's certainly not a formula, right? A plus B plus C equals calling. And you're right. Definitely, we need training, mentorship, and all the rest. So I guess this is just some broad, very broad strokes. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Wayne.
Just a real quick comment.
Yeah.
A pastor once told me it's a lot easier to steer a truck, a car, or a ship if it's moving.
Mm.
And I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're doing something, God can redirect you. God can change your course. But you need to be doing something.
That's right. And what I'm saying is, and as we're doing it, let's consider some of these broad stroke guidelines, and I hope they're helpful to you. Yeah, thank you. There's no chapter on verse for Fides or Chris. I'm sorry, right? Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
There are times when God has you in training to do something in the future.
Yeah.
And you may not know what it is.
This is true. Completely, yeah.
And this is what I have been trained for.
Yeah.
And you get a comfort in realizing that you are doing what God wants you to do when He wants you to do it.
That's right, yeah. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I was going to throw out a counterexample out there. Like, for example, why did the Israelites get put in the wilderness for 40 years, right? That's a long time. But we won't. Here's what I'm going to do, because I'm going to respect their time. I know you guys didn't get a break from me last week, so I'm going to make sure we do have a break. I'm going to say one last thing on this slide, and we'll come back, okay, to do a couple more things. But here's the last thing I want to say. If you read on in Acts, you get to chapter 17, and there, of course, you know that it says that God has appointed every person for the time and place at which they would live, right? Now, Paul is actually using this in a slightly different context, but that is still nevertheless a truth. We are, in terms of our generation and our geography, where we're supposed to be, okay? Now, given that, what is God doing in our geography and in our generation that you can contribute to? Right. So again, another way of thinking about calling. Okay. All right. Let me allow you a break. We'll come back together at 25. How's that? Thanks. All right. Well, let's see. I guess we can say a couple final words here by way of encouragement. It really kind of comes in your notes as well. One thing I guess I wanted to encourage us with was just kind of some personal things that I've gone through where, and I know a lot of us have really good stories to share about this as well, but I share this with my college students in particular because they're in college, and I tell them that that there is very, very few things in my life that I regret. And I think you can live in God's kingdom, believe that God redeems things, and still have genuine regret. I think that's possible. One of those things for me, again, very few, but the one that stands out is the fact that as I was leaving college, I actually lost touch with a lot of my very close friends. You know, we spent 4 years, 24/7, as it were, right, together for 4 years, and wonderful years growing together. But, you know, back then, email was just kind of coming out and all of that, so it was a little bit harder to stay in touch. You know, we didn't have color television. I always joke about that. But, you know, it was harder to stay in touch, right? Okay, Brenda. Feel free to grab a drink if you need. But, you know, with that said, and we can get into all kinds of divine providence and free will and all of that, and how does God work and redeem and so forth, and it's a complex mystery that, you know, for over more than 2,000 years of Christian theology, over into Greek philosophy, that we have yet to really decipher. And I don't know if that mystery is going to be solved anytime soon, of how God works in providence, and yet we still have free will, or do we, and all the rest. But what I do want to say is I do believe that God redeems things. And where exactly he enters in, did he know from way before that you were going to make a mistake and that he was going to enter? Let's not worry about that. All I know for now, our purposes, is that God does redeem. And I think he's redeemed that part of my life in many interesting ways along the way. And not the least of which is for me to encourage, especially my students at Biola, that to hold on to those really cool friendships that are formed in college. And they really do take to that, I think. So if there's a way to redeem riches regret, as it were, maybe that's just one of those ways. I guess a phrase that I like to use here is that redemption flattens fear. So a lot of us are fearful. Oh, especially, you know, should I give up my good job and try to start a business? Because, I feel like that's my calling, but you see what I'm saying? And others of you are like, well, gosh, I'm this is secure, I'm doing this well, but I'm really passionate about this over here. All the rest. The key thing is, let's not operate out of fear. Yes, use wisdom, definitely. But if it's fear that's holding us back, that might be something we might want to reconsider. You know, fear of finances not being there, fear of, you know, name it, right? Not actually achieving the dream that you had. So let's not worry, because even if, again, using very loose language here, even if you make a mistake in God's economy, so to speak, God is still in the business of redeeming those mistakes. So let's let redemption flatten our fear, as it were, deflate maybe our fear. Oh, yeah.
So it's a tough one that, yeah, he thought he failed, but to him, you know,
that's right.
I mean, I'm still here, believing.
Yeah. That's right. No, that's great. I just thought of this when you said that. Because even if we make decisions, we're like, okay, we're going to make such a good decision that it's not going to fail, right? Even if we try, we couldn't make those decisions. There are no such perfect decisions anyway. So let's take comfort in the fact that we do our homework, but at the end of the day, even then, it's not going to be a very good decision, and God will have to redeem it, and he does, right? So, that's important to remember.
You know, it's amazing. And because I know it benefits me because of my grandmother, so I can share this with my grandkids. Mm. Simple ways, simple thoughts, when they ask questions.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, and actually, you've been a huge encouragement to me as well. In fact, I share this with my wife. I said sometimes I get a lot of flack from the group. No, I just I said sometimes it's not easy, you know, navigating the waters because they got their chops up and all of it. But I did share with her. I said, you know, there are some people who really take to the things that we're discussing, and I mentioned you, and she was very, you know, encouraged too. And so. The Lord orchestrates those sorts of things, I think. And it's really, it's kind of cool just to be a part of it, isn't it? That's right. Yeah, and we need it. Yeah, I rarely tweet, right? I think I've tweeted 5 things in my life, literally. But one of the things I remember retweeting some 5 years ago or whenever it was, I wrote, because it has to be short, right? So I wrote, revere gray hairs, right? I thought about that, right? Because I was thinking of Proverbs and actually how the glory of older men are their gray hairs, glory of older people. And we need that generational wisdom, which today, and I have this other critique on horizontal Christianity. I'm friends with 3 other people who look like me, walk like me, and are about my age. But I have so much to learn from people above me, right? You know, who have walked before me, and yet we don't have that. And so this goes back to Wayne's point about individualization, fragmentation. Our whole lives are so fragmented. It's really just me and a couple buddies, which is, we need that too, right? But gosh, we have so much to learn from those who have walked before us. And so, yeah, thanks for sharing that. It goes both ways, definitely. Yeah.
Just real quick, I'm a substitute teacher in a school that caters to juveniles like us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always tell the kids, if I'm not willing to learn as we share, shame on me.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I do learn from you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I can learn from you, and I want to learn from you.
Yeah.
And the kids are like, he wants to learn from me.
Yeah.
You know, they can't believe that somebody older wants to learn something from them.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right. And they appreciate that. Okay. That's a question. All right. So this is the kind of the last thing we'll share here. I actually had a student I guess I was kind of sort of mentoring him. And one of the first questions he asked me, this is an office hours this semester before we started the mentorship. But he asked me a question that kind of stuck. He asked me, Professor Park, what would you tell your 20-year-old self? And I'd never had someone ask that question. And I thought, oh, I'm getting old. No, I'm just kidding. I thought, oh, okay. That's a really, really wise question, right? And so I had to sit there and think about it, and I came up with a list. And the reason he chose 20, well, of course, is because he is 20, and this is kind of catering to that group. But I actually asked this same question to a couple professors who are much older than I am. I asked them, what would you tell your 40-year-old self, right? And so this is just kind of again, going back to the generational point here, is that there's so much wisdom to learn from the generation above us, and 20 years is technically a generation. So this is why I have it up here. But I guess the point I'm trying to make here is what would we tell anyone who's either 20 or 20 years younger than us, right? And how can we learn from people who have walked before us? Here are the things that I've learned in my 40 years of life, right? They're just 3. And this is what... yeah, just 3. That's it. Sorry, guys. All I have for you. Actually, to be honest, I think I'll just share 1. Believe it or not, because the other 2 may not be as applicable, but this is precisely what I would share. Or if you want the other ones, I'll share, because maybe you have, again, grandkids or whoever that you might think this is useful for. But the first thing, and I put numbers in them for a reason, but I said the first thing I told my student Jordan was, hey, find a wise mentor or 2. Right? Find a wise mentor or 2 that you can hopefully walk with for the next 20, 40 years. Why? Because this is kind of like that, if you have a genie and they give you 3 wishes, and what do you wish for? Or they give you 1 wish, what do you wish for? You wish for 3 more, right? Because if you have a mentor, that piece of advice, if you have a mentor, then it's like a lifetime of good advice that you can get, right? So that's the first advice I gave Jordan was, find a mentor or 2 that you can really trust, that you can really share everything with, and who can really kind of help you navigate, you know, the tough waters of life. And so he appreciated that. Again, the second thing I tell 20-year-olds typically is what I tell them is forge kingdom friendships. And you guys know I like to alliterate here, so just another F. But forge kingdom friendships. And what do I mean by kingdom friendships? Well, we all have plenty of friendships, but friendships that are oriented around wanting to help each other build the kingdom, right, in our respective callings. And letting it be, because in my own life, you know, I actually have a lot of friends that are just kind of buddies, and that's really cool, but honestly, we don't spend the bulk of our time talking about ways we can really encourage each other and walk more faithfully and fruitfully. We just don't. Now, there are those others of friends in my community that I do that with, right? And so what I'm saying is at least find 3 to 5 folks that you can say, you know what? God willing, for the next 40 years, we're going to keep checking up on each other. We're going to keep asking those hard questions. We're going to keep each other accountable, right? And this is, again, going back to redeeming riches, regret kind of thing. But 3 to 5. In fact, they've done all kinds of interesting studies on this. The number here is actually quite important. There are very few people who successfully lead lives of close friendships with more than 3 to 5 people. It's very difficult. If you look at your own lives, do we really have more than 3 to 5? Right, so don't. What I tell my students, don't aim for like 10. Oh, we're all going to be close for the next 100 years. No, that's probably not going to happen, right? Don't just have just one person that you're friends with, and that's it. Try to make it Trinitarian. To be honest, I think there's actually a lot of business books that are written about how three is a core. The core of three is a hugely important business principle. I think it's also true with friendships. So there's a core of three. And so that's why I say 3 to 5, because sometimes a couple drop off. Okay, and then finally, you're not going to believe I say this, but I actually do. The third F is formulate a marriage plan. That's what I actually tell them. And actually, the students really do appreciate this. And again, I put numbers to it. Now, whenever you put numbers to anything that's personal, it's really weird, right? You're like 3 to 5 up. Sorry, you're gone. You're number 6. But they're guidelines, right? Now, what do I mean by 3 to 5 here? Obviously not number of partners. I always have to clarify that. But much more importantly, most obviously, what I mean by that is, or sorry, more plainly what I mean by that is number of years, right? And why do I say that? The students that I'm teaching are, again, around 20. So in 3 to 5 years, my encouragement to them is to really consider having a marriage plan that'll consummate, sometime in the 3 to 5 year range. Why? Again, it's not a hard and fast. You're not a sinner if you're 26 and not married. Obviously not, right? But I'm saying this because actually, in a short decade, our median age of marriage has moved 9 years in America, if I have the sociology on that correct. Christian Smith and many others study this very carefully. But there's reasons for it, right? Grad school, people delay marriage, economics, it's a little bit harder to buy a home and buy a ring and all the rest, right? So it's there's some sociological reasons for it. But my encouragement to the students is there is, I think, there's a beauty to having a marriage that's on the younger end. Because one, actually, if you just do surveys on this, people are 50% less likely to get into a divorce if they marry before 25 than if they marry after, which is a crazy statistic. We all know that in America, the divorce rates are already at 50% or higher, right? Actually, some studies show that evangelicals are higher, but I don't know. Those are questionable studies. But anyways, we're quite close. Nevertheless, it's right about 50 for all the across the board. So my encouragement is, look, the odds are already stacked, right, against us. And so let's do whatever we can to try to stave off those statistics. Now, don't get me wrong here, and I always tell the students, look, obviously, some of them are already married, right, in my class, and that's great. They didn't have to wait 3 to 5 years. But the fear is that we continue to push off marriage so far, right, that the median age of marriage is already rising, that there's just, marriage is one of those things which is the bottommost foundation of our society in terms of on the human level, that we're obviously not getting very well in our country. But to have that slip through our fingers, I think, yes, people are going to look back on our generation and say, wow, they got a few things pretty messed up, one of which, of course, is abortion. But the other thing they're going to look at and say, why couldn't they get marriage right? Not just in terms of same sex, yeah, that's huge too, but why were they marrying at 40 and expecting to have children at 45 and then having grandkids when they're, what, 90? You know what I'm saying? You guys, okay, sorry for the absurdity, but I'm just trying to encourage a generation of students to really reconsider, wait a second, our human bodies were designed to have, there's an appropriateness and a normativity to our human nature, right? And that's something that in our technology-driven world, technology will solve everything. I can have a kid when I'm 50 and I'm fine because of artificial womb. Yes, that's possible. But is it flourishing according to our nature? And that's something I want to recapture. right? Now, 101 examples, one of which is me. I got married when I was 35, so I'm not in there. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm really just trying to encourage a generation to say, wait a second, maybe the fact that human history for 9,990 years was kind of had it pretty much right, and maybe the latest, our generation, isn't the greatest. Maybe the newest isn't the truest. And this chronological snobbery that C.S. Lewis talks about, oh, the later we come, the smarter we are. No, we have some wisdom to look at from thousands of years of human history. Now, the third one is always a little bit of a harder sale, obviously, sale in general. But I just want to put it out there because I don't want us to say, well, in our very relativistic culture, oh, you know, 45 works for you, 14 works for you, okay, everyone's happy. Well, no, there's a normativity to our human nature. There's a way it flourishes and there's a way it doesn't. And if for no other reason than to kind of counteract that relativism, I have that as a thought. So my last thought, let me just finish here, Roddy, and then we'll open up to questions. But my last thought is my last thought is from your notes. Is as I say in your notes that when it comes to worldview, when it comes to thinking about what grounds our worldview, as I share in your notes, ultimately, it's kind of one of those things where as we all get older, as we all know this, no matter how profound or insightful or deep you want to be about Christian theology, apologetics, and philosophy, I honestly do believe that that Sunday school song of reading your Bible and praying every day is the fundamentals, and it really is. And so, yes, worldview, insight, theology, that's important, but ultimately all of this is grounded in Scripture. And so if there's ever a final thought I can leave with you, is to really, let's continue to go back to Scripture. That's what's going to form our worldview. And so, provided that we're praying, the Spirit will guide us into believing all that is true. So that's my last thought. I guess I will put my email up here for those of you who want to stay in touch. I'm actually very happy to do that. Actually, wherever I give talks or whatever, I usually put up my email because it's this weird thing about human society and modern life where we're all fragmented. It's like, oh, I met you for 50 minutes, gave a talk, and have a nice life, you know? So I like this idea of being able to actually stay in touch. Excuse me. There's my email, so let's see if we can do that. Okay. Can I just close in prayer for us? And then Roddy, and I think I saw some more hands here, and we can kind of chat after we close. All right, let's pray. Excuse me. Father God, Lord, we thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity that we've had to just to study a bit here together, discuss, to grow together, to challenge one another, and to think through all the things that you have for us in your word and in your world. Father, we ask that we would continue to seek you, to make that primary calling, our devotion to you, be so fundamental, and that all this talk about impact and analysis and all that would only flow from a deep devotion to you. God, remind us of how important that is when we get off track. May we not just seek to be great, but actually to be good, to have a character that's like yours, as Chris was praying at the beginning. Lord, help us each day to become more and more like you. And so we ask this for all of us and for those of us who couldn't join tonight. And we do thank you for this wonderful space. And most importantly, we thank you for the relationship we have with you through the death and resurrection of your Son. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Okay, so why don't we hang out a little bit? And
first, I want to tell you that I have learned a lot in your class.
Oh.
And I have learned a lot of ideas that I carry with me on a daily basis. So for that, I'm thankful.
Oh, thanks, Roddy. I appreciate that.
I've been advised and mentored young people, teenagers, and parents of teenagers. And the reason why I asked about 20-year-olds is I have a 20-40 college prep courses, and then if you can't make a major college, you go to a junior college.
Sure.
By then you're 20 years old.
Yep.
At that point, you can decide what you want to do with your profession.
For the next 40 years, is that what it is?
Or college.
Right, right. Yeah.
And then you have 40 years, you have another 20 years to get to the top of your profession.
Mm. That's right. No, that's great. It's interesting that you say that, because when I was teaching high school, I taught at a public high school for about 5 years, I had this thing I called the 440 rule, which is you could either party it up, be, you know, Mr. Jock or whatever for 4 years, and generally speaking, there's always exceptions, generally speaking, the next 40 years, you might be playing a bit of catch-up. Not necessarily. But you can't, generally, that's how it works out, right? You're the most popular guy, and then for 40 years, you go, oh man, I should have spent. Or you could spend these 4 years investing, right, and developing a character and thinking through the rest of your life so that you're setting yourself up for, you know, a college and then a career. And this is a purely, you know, secular, plural high school, just a public high school. And so, but that made sense, I think, to a lot of them. So that this is the kind of thing we need to help our people to see, because we just don't have voices like that speaking into the next generation.
Yeah, but that's true, but you can't wait until they're in college. They have
this was in high school. Yeah.
In high school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed in your three, you find a mentor, and you forge friendships, and you formulate a marriage, but you didn't talk about calling.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking that myself. It's so funny. I was just thinking about that myself. I was like, how is that connected to calling? I don't know. Let's turn off the mic first. Actually, I think this for me was really just a, if I could share a few final words ever, what would they be? And that's what it was. It was like, this is our last time together, and this is my last, you know, week on this lecture series. And so this is kind of the, doesn't every teacher reserve the right to, what would, if you had to give your final talk, what would it be? And this, something along these lines would be what it is for me. So it's not completely connected, you're right.
I'm sure our paths will cross again.
Right, yeah. But at that point, I don't think I can give you these three things. So it'd be awkward. Like, hey, how's it going? Here's three things for you. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, I hope so. Oh, yeah.
Maybe you were saying just a 3-year, 5-year period of being in this group kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the hope that somewhere along 3 to 5 years that students, as they finish college, they would, be married, you know, relatively within the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay, and they're actually talking about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Married,
yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, like full on.
I was taking it in a different sense.
Like really practical.
And my singles group back in my 20s, because the guys, there was a Christian culture. Oh, no, we're just friends.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, that was partly my, so this is the, I'm not going to date, I'm dating Jesus, right? Like that whole thing, right? So there's that dualistic, these are not mutually exclusive. You can date Jesus, so to speak. You can be fully devoted to Jesus and still seek a marriage partner. By the way, I actually, you know, kind of almost in response to Roddy's question, but I actually feel very free to share this kind of advice with my students. The reason is this. You won't believe it, and I'm happy to share this publicly because he is too. But when I was taking a philosophy of time class, you guys are like, there's something that is not very practical. But I was taking a philosophy of time class with William Lane Craig. And, you know, I did okay in the class. But what he did is he would come in every day, I kid you not, every morning he would come in, and he would start off with what he called sage pieces of advice, right? And they would be everything from, like, here's some good study tips when you're in grad school, right? Things you would expect, right? To here's how you work out at the gym, And I was blown away. I was like, I kid, like he was doing like the whole like pyramid. And I was like, wow, like he's not joking. You know, like we're about to talk about the A and B theory of time, but he's talking about how you do reps and sets and how you have to increase reps as you decrease weight. I was like, wow, right? Everyone was like, is this a joke? Like, are we on camera? But here's what was beautiful about that is to him, again, all of life is sacred. All of life is worship. So when you're at the gym or you're at the library writing your paper, to him, this is what Christian discipleship and Christian education is about. And it ought to be that practical. And so ever since I took that class, now that I'm teaching classes, I have this freedom of like, you know what? Let's get really, really real about certain things. And let me just tell you how I see where our culture needs to kind of maybe think a little bit differently on that kind of thing. So that's the kind of the... That was the what's the word? Genesis of that. Sorry.
I see those three things. That's a big chunk of
one's
of good closing ideas. Because,
yeah.
I mean, if you can find somebody that can guide you and direct you, you're way ahead of the game. And if you have two, like I said before, that African guy, if you have 3 to 5 good friends, most of your problems aren't going to be problems.
Yeah,
anymore.
That's true.
And
if you marry well,
from marriage, but, I mean, we could talk about that forever.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And come to think of it, you're right. I mean, even these things, as we were asking earlier during the break, these are part of our calling, right? To be a wife is a part of our calling. Right, it's not the only part, but it is a crucial part, and that's something I missed out on. I actually didn't say, but yeah, these things do tie in that way because it's all a part of our calling. Yeah.
I'm curious Chris. Why you have them for a 20-year-old to think of marriage? I don't know if I missed that.
Yeah, so that's the part that we were talking about earlier. Is just kind of the drift of how the median age of marriage. Actually, I think I misspoke. It was not 9 years; it's been 6 years. Over the course of just 10 years, I believe. It went up by 6 years. So, it used to be, 23, and then it became 29. Christian Smith, he's a sociologist at Notre Dame. He happens to be a Christian. He writes about a lot of this. Emerging adolescence and all that, right? Adulthood, you know, going to our 30s and still being in our adolescence and all that. So, in fact, this is Japan, but there's other places too. In our culture, because of the video gaming culture partly, in Japan, there's this thing called... I forget the Japanese term for it, but basically it means something like isolatedness or something like that, where they will literally shut themselves indoors for months at a time, never leaving the home literally, and turn that kind of episode into a season of life, and now you're all of a sudden years later, you're literally in your mother's basement, as they say, right? And so Hidekomi or something like that. Anyways, emergent, what do they call it? Emergent adolescence or emerging adulthood or I forget the term. But adolescence goes from 13 to 30 now as opposed to 13 to 18 or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Oh. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Kids?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So this is good. You know, you'll be able to pick out certain things in culture and critique it. That, again, that's really what we're trying to do here. So, So thanks for allowing me this privilege to walk with you guys.
We've had the course.
We're done.